Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Cherry versus Auburn Gear. Mr. Macy.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Barry Macy. And I am here today representing the class of retirees, folks who have retired from the Auburn Gear plant in Auburn, Indiana. We have not specified in the briefs, but the record shows that there are a total of, well, at the time this case began, there were a total of approximately 178 retirees and their spouses. Some of them have died since the case began. But for our purposes here, 126 of the retirees and spouses are pre-1991 retirees. So those are the folks with the viable claim. I am going to begin by addressing the basis for the district court's decision in this case. The district court concluded that the collectively bargained insurance agreements unambiguously limited the duration of the benefits to the term of each agreement. We respectfully disagree with the district court's conclusion and are asking you to reverse. Specifically, the district court relied on the language of Section 1 of the collectively bargained insurance agreements.
Right. Now, Section 1 talks about the program of benefits that the employer agreed to provide.
Correct, Your Honor.
For the term of the agreement.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why doesn't the term program include the benefits provided to the retirees as well as current employees? I mean, health insurance is one of the benefits that's expressly identified as part of that program, and that's the very benefit that is at issue here.
Correct, Your Honor. Section 1 does talk about the during the period of the agreement, and then it lists 13 benefits, all of which are supplied or were provided to the active employees. Now, with respect to the language you're addressing, hospital and surgical benefits, and also the prescription drug benefits, those benefits appear in two places in the agreement. They appear in Section 2 with respect to the active employees, and they appear in Section 6 with respect to the retirees. So what we have then is we have two possible choices with respect to the reference in Section 1. Section 1 can apply to just the reference in Section 2.
Why? Here's my problem. Section 1 of those agreements spoke generally to a program of benefits, as I just, you know, noted,
yes,
including the health insurance benefits that the company agreed to maintain during the term of the of each agreement.
Correct.
And I know that there was a separate section of the agreement that described retiree benefits, but why do you think that suggests that there was a separate program of benefits for retirees, or that a company's obligation to provide health benefits to retirees was perpetual? That's what I'm not getting.
Okay. Well, the benefits for the retirees were distinct. They were different benefits than the benefits for the active employees. As you read these agreements, you'll see that the date of retirement is very important because the benefits that are afforded the retirees relate to the benefits that were in place at the time that they retired. So you're talking about two sets of benefits. And the purpose, of course, of for benefits for active employees and retired employees is considerably different. One, for the retirees, this is, in effect, deferred compensation. So the issue, and what we contend is ambiguous, is that where you have these two choices and you have only one reference in Section 1, how do we know that the parties intended that single reference in Section 1 to apply both to health benefits for active and health benefits for retirees? If you will, it's a little bit like the peerless situation, only we know that there are two choices because they're both in the agreement.
But, of course, retirees who retired prior to or during 1982 didn't have a vested right to health benefits, so our plaintiffs are no worse for having retired later, are they?
Our plaintiffs,
you see my problem?
Our plaintiffs retired both before and after 1983. We have both. If it's not clear, the company terminated insurance for everyone. So there are no retirees who are, that includes
right.
the pre-1992 retirees.
Right. In other words, they're not. Everyone's in the same boat.
Correct. With respect to the employer's action. But what we are contending is that where you have a reference, and that reference could be to either one or both, that creates ambiguity. And our argument is strengthened by what happened in 1991, because in 1991, the parties amended the agreement, the language of the agreement, and specifically and explicitly included the term retiree insurance benefits in Section 1.
Yeah, I understand the only issue here, the only dispute is to the prior agreements. I mean, everyone...
Correct.
Everyone agrees.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. But we're contending that by amending the agreement in 1991... The employer created a situation that is identical to Rossetto, where you have two agreements, one of which explicitly limits the terms of the agreement, and the other one is ambiguous with respect to the duration. So that is, the district court concluded that as a matter of law, the only way to interpret this agreement is to say that the reference in Section 1 includes both the active employees and the retirees. And we respectfully suggest that there's no basis for saying as a matter of law that that is true. What makes us believe that when people were negotiating in 1980, they treated both the retiree insurance and the active insurance as being limited to the term of the agreement? And when you look at our extrinsic evidence, it's perfectly apparent that they didn't, because when they began negotiations in 1983, the company negotiators were of the opinion that those retiree insurance benefits could not be changed. That's undisputed evidence. So if they believed at the beginning of negotiations in 1983 that the benefits could not be changed, and these were the same folks who negotiated the 1980 agreement, how can we conclude that they intended that single reference in Section 1 to apply to the retiree insurance benefits?
When they talk about a program of benefits, that's how.
Well, except that the question, again, is what's included in that program, and they have...
Well, health benefits are included. Health
yes.
insurance was included.
Agreed.
And it's... And was limited to the term of the agreement.
Health insurance was, but
we so often look at Section 1, don't we? I mean, Section 1 always seem to set out your parameters, don't they?
But we submit that this is still a leap. If you look back to the concurring opinion in Bidlack, which I believe you joined, in that opinion.
What was I thinking?
The author of the opinion stated that back in the 70s and early 80s, employers, when they provided retiree insurance benefits, simply did not approach these benefits as benefits limited by the term of the agreement. They were giving these benefits for life. So it's a question of getting inside the minds of the folks who are at that bargaining table and figuring out what their intent is, not addressing the issue from the perspective of 2005 and probably a half a dozen to a dozen cases that have been decided by this court. It's the question of the party's intent is a question of fact.
Well, to the point you just went by, Mr. Macy, the dozen or so cases of this court, is it your position that there is no tension between our recent cases, when I say recent, let's say the last 6 or 7 years, and what you're advancing in this case?
Yes, I agree. I say that there is
agree,
no...
Agree with what? There is some tension?
No, I believe that we have made our case based on your case, your decisions, with respect to this essential issue of ambiguity. And when you have one reference to health insurance in the opening paragraph, and yet you have two references to different types of health insurance later on in the agreement, how do we know that that first reference encompasses both of them when there is plentiful evidence that that was not the intent of the parties?
You don't get to extrinsic evidence unless there is a textual ambiguity. And what about the text of Section 1 of the agreement gives rise to a reasonable interpretation that it excludes retiree benefits? Unless we can say that it's reasonable to interpret Section 1 to exclude retiree benefits and be limited to active employee benefits, then you don't get to the next step in the analysis.
Well, what we contend is that Section 1 leaves open the possibility. It doesn't foreclose the possibility.
Why is that a reasonable interpretation? What in the language of that clause would make that a reasonable interpretation? It refers, as Judge Rovner has said repeatedly now, to a program of benefits generically.
Because to foreclose the issue, it would have to say health insurance, parentheses, both active and retiree. And it does not say that. You have to read the agreement as a whole, and when you go to Section 6, the Section 6 language is clearly suggestive of a duration of benefits that extends beyond the agreement. Section 6 talks about continuation of benefits until the death of the spouse. It uses the word continuation very expansively, and it seems obvious that they are using the word continuation to talk about continuation throughout retirement. So when you read Section 1 and Section 6 together, it's apparent that these individuals were not intending to limit the retiree benefits, and then the extrinsic evidence, and it is possible and permissible to use extrinsic evidence to create ambiguity, which is what Rossetto does.
To clear up ambiguity.
But Rossetto specifically uses it to create the ambiguity. The extrinsic evidence in Rossetto was almost identical to what we have. They had a second agreement in Rossetto that explicitly limited the benefits, but the agreement that the court was looking at did not. And the court said that extrinsic evidence, where you have the same party to two agreements, one of which explicitly limits the benefits to the duration, and that's what happened in 1991, but the other one which doesn't explicitly limit it, then you have an extrinsic ambiguity that creates an ambiguity.
Say that again. An extrinsic ambiguity.
Extrinsic evidence creates an ambiguity. I'm sorry, I misspoke.
Want to reserve a little time?
Yeah, I would like to reserve a little time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Macy.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Anderson.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kathleen Anderson, and I represent the appellee, Auburn Gear, here today. This case boils down to two components, primarily the first component. The first component being the written word. And the written word is set forth in the various agreements. Secondarily, we have the conduct of the parties, because when we look to the prior case law of this court, we see in Corral that we should look to the language of the agreements, and then secondarily to the conduct of the parties.
Prior to 1991,
was
it clear when the agreement talked about the program of benefits that would be provided for the term of the agreement, that program included the benefits provided to retirees?
Absolutely. Let me address that specifically. Now, pre-1991, we had a little bit different language, and here's why. The 1991 agreement has a different title even. It's called the Health and Well-Being Agreement. Before that time, we had collectively bargained insurance agreements. And so what you see in the 1991 agreement is an entire change in the format of the agreement. And so if you look at the elements set forth in Section 1, you will see that they correspond with each of the sections that follow because the section headings changed. So when we look at the pre-1991 agreements, they were dealing with not section headings, but elements. And so when you look at the district court did a very nice job in setting forth a chart of the various elements set forth in those agreements, showing that there are certain elements that apply to both retirees and to the active employees. Now, if you follow what the appellants say, you could go ahead and list those two elements again, and they would say exactly the same thing in that Section 1. Now, that doesn't make sense. So the drafters, way back from at least 1971, identified the elements, and those included the retirees. And when you look at the word program, clearly the drafters were looking at an entire program for everyone under that agreement, and that is just like Corral. Now, just like Corral, we have three important elements. We have the integration clauses, and I would say that the integration clauses that we have in these agreements are even stronger than that those set forth in Corral. And that is, while the language varies just slightly, the agreements say that this agreement, the collective bargaining agreement, is considered the full working arrangement along with the insurance agreement. Like Corral, we have definite clauses for these agreements. We have three-year terms not only set forth in the insurance agreements but also the collective bargaining agreements. And then the key component of these agreements for the purpose of this appeal is Section 1, and I would call that the map for the rest of the agreement. And the appellants would like to distinguish this case from Corral. I cannot do so. When you look at the language from Corral, you see that it said Article 7 in Corral, for the term of this agreement, same as we have here, the employer, at its sole cost and expense, shall provide, identifying the various elements, major medical, etc., in accordance with and as summarized in Appendix A attached here too. Now, the only difference between our provision and the Corral agreement is that we didn't have an appendix. Instead of saying as set forth in the appendix, it says as set forth in this very same agreement. And of course, in the arguments in the Corral case, the argument was by the appellants that this was, or by the employees, was that this was somehow not good enough because it was just in the appendix. Here we have it in the actual agreement. So you have a program that can be under a master plan or multiple plans with an insurance carrier or multiple carriers, a program of these various items, some of which apply to both retirees and active employees and some of which only apply to active employees, and then to provide further strength to that provision, it says that these various elements are as set forth in this agreement.
In Corral, one of the articles of the contract contained an integration clause.
Yes.
That emphasized the inclusiveness of the contract. Do we have that here?
Yes, we do. We have it within the collective bargaining agreement. In the 1980 agreement, for instance, section 9.1.1, it is understood that this agreement, together with the following agreements, shall
would
be...
Would you give me that section again?
9.1.1. And it's the same in the 1983 and the subsequent agreements. In fact, you can find that in the appellee's appendix at page 7.
Page 7.
For the 1983 agreement. It'll be considered, it was a package deal. It was the collective bargaining agreement and the insurance agreement. And so we have clear language set forth in the agreement. Now, under the law of this court, and you find that in the Rossetto case, sets forth the various principles nicely. Bidlock talks about, you know, employers adamant against assuming perpetual obligations can eliminate all doubt by insisting on a clause that makes any entitlement expire on the date of the agreement. The Corral case identifies the very factors that we have here. So under the law of this court, not only must the retiree show the absence of a durational limit, but they also must show some sort of affirmative indication that retiree benefits were intended to continue. There's no patent ambiguity in these agreements. According to the Rossetto case, the patent ambiguity must be apparent from reading the contract itself. We do not have that here.
If Section 1 had said programs with an S, would we have a different situation?
I don't think so, because the Section 1 says that program equals what is set forth in various, you know, a master plan or a plan. So I don't think it makes any difference whether that's singular or plural, because the plurality is set forth in the preceding clause. The appellants have referred to various portions of the agreement that they think show some patent ambiguity. I think what we need to do is to look at that introductory Section 1 the same way that the Corral case did. And the Corral case read the limitations in each of the provisions of the appendix. So for each section, because we have that portal, that Section 1 that says that the plan is as set forth in this agreement and for the term of this agreement, that applies to each provision in the entire agreement, you know, including any language that might suggest a continuation of benefits for the term of this agreement.
Ms. Anderson?
Yes.
Mr. Macy's brief references what he believes to be a major factual difference between Corral. And that's the absence of the mention of the Medicare supplement benefits, which are found in 6 and not in Section 1, and obviously argues then for the introduction of extrinsic evidence. What say you to that? Is that a major factual difference, number one? And two, if not, or if it is, how do you respond to that argument?
I do not think it's a significant factual difference. Now, remember that the Medicare supplement merely allows the coverage, it addresses the existing coverages of the policy. So if I turn, for instance, to, I think it's appellant's supplement, to, I think it's 74. If you see in the 1986 agreement, it says for current retirees who are eligible for and receiving Medicare, and it says this program will provide coverage upon exhaustion of Medicare benefits to the level of benefits normally provided by the current retiree group insurance plan. That just kicks it back to the elements that we have in the plan, so you have the same, it's covered, it's in the same the categories. Now, and the fact that it was or was not included does not affect the fact that that the elements of the retiree coverage were included in the different elements set forth in Section 1. That's the elements set forth in the district court's chart.
The short answer is that it's a health plan, and Section 1 refers to health plans.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Sickness insurance, hospital and surgical benefits, outpatient diagnostic x-rays, etc. That's all in Section 1.
I think Section 1 is the key to this case. Now, I can... So at that point, you go to the next argument, and that is that despite the fact that Section 1 is so clear, somehow we should get into a Raffles or a Peerless situation and try to find some latent ambiguity. We've already addressed the 1991 change. That does not show any latent ambiguity in Section 1 in the prior agreements. That was an entire restructuring. And just merely showing, going to the section heads in 1991 where you had elements prior to that time. There's no latent ambiguity because of statements made, allegedly made, as reflected in some cryptic notes from 1983 by individuals who had not been involved in drafting the language prior to that time. That does not reveal any latent ambiguity. And I would suggest that the appellants are turning to the concept of latent ambiguity not to show any ambiguity, but to show that somehow there was a different subjective intent. And that's not allowed by the case law of this court. I think this court has perhaps already recognized that this 1983 grandfathering of certain retirees, which affected just, I think, about 15 individuals, merely put them in the same shoes as the folks that retired earlier, and you have to look at whether there was a vested benefit for those who retired earlier, and the answer is no. You have the same Section 1 with the same restrictions, just like Corral. Now, as I indicated, Bidlock has started with some guidance to employers and those negotiating these kinds of plans that employers adamant against assuming perpetual obligations need to have and the agreement expire. That was followed by the Pabst case and the Rosetto cases that set forth some clear rules. We think that we clearly fall within those cases and that they suggest strongly and perhaps dictate that this case be affirmed, that the lower court's decision be affirmed. In Corral, they found that there were no gaps crying out to be filled or the agreement was not ambiguous in any way, and so they found that there were no lifetime benefits. We ask that that same result be found here and that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Mr. Macy.
Thank you. In my just a few minutes left, with respect to Corral, Corral is distinguishable because, as we state in our briefs, Corral had this language during the period of this agreement, and it related to the entire package of benefits in Appendix A. So by definition, the during the term of this agreement applied to every benefit in Appendix A, and that's what the decision pointed out by saying we could add during the term of this agreement before every one of those. That's not our situation. Here, we have to assume to get to the result that the company wants us to get to. We have to assume that when the parties talked about a program of benefits and referred to health insurance in the first section, they were talking about all types of health insurance. And there's no basis for doing that, particularly in light of the fact that the Medicare benefits are conspicuously absent from Section 1. So if Section 1 was meant to identify all of the benefits in the package, including the retiree insurance benefits, it should have been listed, Medicare should have been listed in Section 1. And its absence reveals an intent of the parties not to put retiree insurance benefits or not to cover them by the limiting language of Section 1. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Macy. Thank you, Sampson. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the second case.